I wish they wouldn't always say I sound like the guy from the USA. A rambling boy, they say I've been, and there ain't no place that I ain't seen. But take off me hat and look underneath, I'm a young conservative from Pontenay. I come up to London on a big red bus, plucking me guitar and making a fuss. But a clippy threw me off and he says, ta-ta, and a geezer picked me up, said, I'll make you a star. I said, oh, will it hurt? Oh, I wish they wouldn't always say I sound like the guy from the USA. So he sits me in a room and I'm all alone, just me and his flicking great microphone. I says, well, what shall I sing? I don't know a song. He said, make it up, son, as you go along. Both. Then he took away me suit and tie, and he give me an hat like another guy, and some dirty old jeans that were terrible tight. He said, don't sit down, boy, you'll be all right. I said, sit down? I can't move. I wish they wouldn't always say I sound like the guy from the USA. He wouldn't let me wash or comb me hair. No wonder people stand and stare. You got to have a gimmick, he says to me, so get out and march with a CND. Stamping about in the pouring rain, I decided singing weren't my game. I marched and I marched, and what a relief, I found I was back in Fontenay. Oh, I wish they wouldn't all say I sound like the guy from the USA. I never did get on with them harmonica harnesses anyway. I have one at the back, one at the front, one on each shoulder. Every time I try to play them, I've got a corkscrew neck. Anyone know a bird with a right hand thread?
I just mind a dime on the hair, stomp the table, touch a red.
Yeah! News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us.
Today is Friday, the 15th of November. I'm Christine.
And I'm Morme. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:08 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news, as well as news from around the world brought to you by Democracy Now!
All this plus your weekday or weekend weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada.
Today's top stories and segments are Morgan's interview with Ket Panther of No Whiffs, No Butts, and Episode 3 of In Their Shoes, talking to students about how they would respond to changing public responses if they had been child stars.
As well as Nina's interview with Loro Fukumoto about next week's March to Reclaim Consent. And today's hot topic, how do you think the Canadian image has been changed by the recent media coverage of Toronto Mayor Rob Ford?
All this plus an interview with Doug Doyle, who spoke today at one of the final Ripple Effect events today, and international headlines from Democracy Now!
But first, your campus and local and national news.
Today we have Ket Panther of No Whiffs, No Butts live in studio here to talk to Morgan about the group's plans to start a petition asking UBC to amend the placement of smoker poles, creating a dry covered smoker poles, creating dry covered spaces so that smokers do not congregate around covered doorways.
And we're going to take a quick PSA.
Okay, well, thank you, Ket, for being with us today.
Yeah, no worries. Hey there.
So can you tell the listeners a little bit about what your plans are for the No Whiffs or Butts?
Yeah, so it kind of started off as a group project for Dr. Robert Gateman's economics class, and the idea was to go out and just make a difference either around the UBC campus or in the city. So we thought, hey, this is a really good opportunity. I have a few friends, and we've noticed that around campus there's a lot of cigarette butts that kind of littered all across campus and in front of the doorways of high student volume buildings, and as well as when it rains, smokers kind of locate themselves to these doorways, even though that there's policy number 15 and stuff. It says that you have to be 8 meters, like keep an 8 meter radius from the doorway. So the idea was we want to give smokers the incentive not to smoke in doorways, because we can't just say, hey, you can't smoke. Like, the idea is we were talking about getting designated smoking places, but we can't confine smokers to, like, restricted areas, because
right.
You can't just confine a smoker, right? But the idea is we just wanted to give them the incentive to, like, move away from the doorway. So we had this idea of just bringing in more smoker poles as just 8 meters away from doorways, mm-hmm. give them the incentive to say, hey, I can smoke over here now, just 8 meters from the door, undercover still, with a proper way to dispose of their butts instead of just littering them around campus. So non-smokers don't have to be subject to secondhand smoke. Smokers have a proper place to smoke, as well as just the UBC looks more respectable in the end. So
right.
Yeah.
Now, how are you planning to go about getting signatures for your petition?
We actually didn't really plan on getting signatures at all.
Oh,
as
okay.
weird as that is. Yeah, we just we've been talking with a bunch of the GSS and AMS members,
mm-hmm.
and just trying to start bit by bit. So the idea was to get one smoker pole outside the student union building, because if it's outside a high student volume building like the sub and it works, that can show as an example of saying, hey, wait a minute, this actually does work. And maybe other faculties and buildings around campus can say, hey, if it does work, why can't we do it? And then the campus can slowly be butt-free, I suppose, and act as an example to other schools around the area. So we didn't even want to try to, like, get signatures. We just wanted to say, hey, let's just put up a few polls and give them the incentive, maybe, like, draw chalk on the ground, say, hey, use this or something. Because, yeah, just simple as just giving them the incentive and just having, like, a nice global courteousness.
Right.
Yeah, I guess.
Now, have you talked to anyone at the AMS yet?
Yeah, we're actually trying to get in touch with Colleen Wong right now.
Okay.
And we our main contact right now is of the GSS, and he wants to get together and sit and actually like start doing something.
Wow.
So yeah, it's kind of cool.
Well, that's really, and no, because I know Colleen Wong is, she's on the new subcommittee.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been in talks with them to try to get this kind of thing implemented with the new construction?
We haven't actually spoken about anything regarding the new sub yet. I'm not too sure what's going on there. We're just mostly focusing on the old sub right now.
Okay. Very cool. Now, I'm not sure if listeners are aware, but Vancouver has been putting some sort of butt collection receptacles around sort of high traffic areas in the downtown. Have you guys considered talking to the campus or to the university about putting in anything like that?
We actually, my friend just showed us that article the other day, and we were like, whoa, that's so convenient that it happened like during this whole thing. So we're actually, this weekend we're planning on sending out some emails and sitting down and talking with them to say, hey, maybe we can get some of these boxes, because they look really nice too, and they're inconspicuous, and we can just maybe place them around campus. But yeah, we're planning on getting in touch with them pretty soon.
Very cool.
So, yeah.
Is there anything else you would like to discuss about your plans? Or if people want to get involved, if they can show support.
If we do have a blog site, I think it's just like noifsnobuts.blogspot.ca or something.
Okay.
But yeah, and they can kind of like follow our campaign and what we're doing.
Okay, and we can link that to our Facebook.
Yeah, awesome. And yeah, the one thing was I was contacting a bunch of people in charge of policy number 15, who are in charge of the actual tobacco use and tobacco selling around campus. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these staff members were saying that our problem, it lies in the hands of the security, and they wanted to increase security almost, or like administer fines.
Sort of like prevent people from standing closer to the building?
Yeah, instead of, because I always speak to the security guys just as a joke to say like, hey, what if a guy is smoking, you know, in this doorway? And he always just says, we just shoo him away, which you can't. If someone was to just toss a cigarette butt on the ground, stomp on it, you can't charge them $100 fine, right? It's just such a small act. So it's just about being courteous to everyone, right? So just a mutual benefit from everyone respecting each other.
Now, have there been any concerns with making, you know, these smokers' areas more, almost more comfortable for smokers, that it will encourage people to smoke?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't go about that too much, because you could take UBC Okanagan, as, for example. Around the UBC Okanagan campus, they have a bunch of gazebos, they call them, and they're just really comfortable places to sit down undercover, and they're designated smoking areas. Mm-hmm. But since UBC is already so dense, it's you can't just throw a gazebo up around campus. So pretty much we're just looking at like a smoker pole, undercover, and a bench to sit down at. Nothing too loungy, I suppose. No surround sound music or anything.
And there's been no complaints that, you know, even just by having extra smokers' poles, that it will encourage people to smoke more often?
Not that I've seen, but, you know, that's a good question. Maybe I haven't heard something yet. Yeah.
Well, just because a lot of the criticism around these butt receptacles is that it actually makes smoking seem like it's more acceptable because, you know, the city is...
Yeah.
So just curious if that had come up at all.
That's fair, yeah. There's definitely... We were kind of talking about that concern if, like, we were promoting it just by allowing it. But at the same time, people do smoke, and around the UBC campus, you can't tell people not to smoke. So instead of just being sour about it or getting upset, why don't we just all just get along, throw a smoker pole up there. If you're a smoker, it'd be awesome if you used it. If you're not a smoker, I don't know, just avoid the secondhand smoke as much as you can. I don't know.
Well, thank you very much for coming in today, Kat.
Yeah, thank you for having
me. And good luck with your plans.
Yeah, thanks so much.
We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Hi, everyone. We're from the UBC Food Society.
Yummy.
and we're the only food club at UBC.
We're about feeding students, but also teaching them how to feed themselves. Through our restaurant outings and cooking workshops, we hope to expose you guys to the diversity of cultures, flavors, and food communities Vancouver has to offer.
So if you want to get involved, email us at foodsociety@gmail.com or check up on our website at www.ams.ubc.ca/clubs/foodsociety, or you can even join our Facebook group.
Do you have an approaching test or exam and need help studying? Well, it's time to prepare yourself. The Study Van, www.studyvan.com, is a 100% free website dedicated to helping you achieve excellence. MCAT, History, Chemistry, French, Math, Biology, the Study Van covers it all. Tools are provided so you can create your own study group and do what you need to do. Ace your exam. The Study Van will help you help yourself. Give it a shot, you have nothing to lose, as once again it is a 100% free studying resource. So remember, when you need to study, go to the Study Van, www.studyvan.com.
Hi, my name's Matthew. When I first got back from a military tour in Afghanistan, anytime I heard a siren or even a car alarm, I'd lose it completely. I would turn into a wild man, screaming, waving my arms. People would yell at me, "Shut up, you crazy. Get a job, would ya?" Well, I didn't go out and get a job. I got help instead. Now, I'm in a clean and safe apartment. I have friends and helpers who understand me. I landed a decent job, but I gotta admit, I still don't like car alarms or sirens. I used to think mental illness was a death sentence. I got life instead.
This message was produced by Columbian Center Society and Radio Malaspina in British Columbia.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
We now have your local weather forecast for this weekend, brought to you by Environment Canada. Tonight, periods of rain ending this evening, then partly cloudy. We have winds south 30 to 50 kilometers per hour, becoming northwest 70 earlier this evening, then diminishing to 30 to 50 overnight. The low plus is 3. Tomorrow is mainly going to be sunny, increasing cloudiness late in the afternoon, a high of 8. For Saturday night, it's mainly cloudy, 60% chance of showers overnight, a low plus of 3. On Sunday, cloudy again, with 60% chance of showers, high of 6. So that's this weekend's UBC forecast, brought to you by Vancouver Weather Bulletin, courtesy of Environment Canada.
Next up on today's program, News 101's Nina will be interviewing Lauro Fukumoto, one of the organizers of the March to Reclaim Consent.
Ooh, sorry about that. Okay, so, hey Laura. So this is Lauro Fukumoto. She is from the campaign to Reclaim Consent. The event that they are organizing will be happening next Friday at what time, Laura?
The event will be next Friday, November 22nd at 5 p.m., starting at the sub.
Perfect. Okay, so first thing that we're going to just delve into is the differences between Take Back the Night rally and March to Reclaim Consent. If you could just give me a little bit of an overview. I know that the organization was different.
Sure, yeah. So the March to Reclaim Consent is a sister march to Take Back the Night, and we're taking a little bit of a different angle on it in that we want to address issues that affect wider groups of people. So Take Back the Night was addressing violence against women and women-identified people, but the fact of the matter is that violence affects a variety of groups of people at intersections of oppression. Let me know if you want me to define anything.
Yeah, well, okay, so we were also talking a little bit earlier about how the March to
Take Back the Night rally. It was organized very last minute, and there were a lot of problems in terms of creating a dichotomy on campus around people, yeah. And just the way that you guys would like to counter that with this new campaign.
Yeah. So Take Back the Night, I think it was an important event in that these assaults were happening in such quick succession. So we needed to have something to respond to that. And this is a time sensitive issue. And in terms of activism, like we recognize that we have media attention right now, and we have the attention of people on campus who don't usually involve themselves with these issues, mm-hmm. or have these conversations. So from an activism and an educational perspective, this time we need to act now, mm-hmm. to start trying to have these conversations about what is consent and how do we enact those in our own relationships.
Yeah. And so I guess I was going to ask, in terms of those differences, I know that you said, first of all, you'll be doing a lot more background research.
Yes.
Yeah. Could you go a little bit more into detail about
that? So in response to all of the national media attention we've been receiving about sexual assault on campuses, myself and a few other people have decided to create an organization that we've just named the Campaign to Reclaim Consent. And so throughout the year, we're hoping to continue these conversations with other events and other projects. So, for example, we have like a documentary being made next Friday.
What?
We're creating a series of YouTube videos, mm-hmm. And then a research project looking at different marches that have happened, I'm sure, on campus, but we don't have any archival photos and we don't have that history to back it up. So we want to know what has happened on campus already. So in terms of the march, how that will differ from Take Back the Night is we are hoping to have more of a peaceful solidarity march. Mm-hmm. We're starting at the Goddess of Democracy, and we're going to make a circuit around campus.
Okay.
And then when we get back...
Where is the Goddess of Democracy again?
The Goddess of Democracy has moved to the north side of the sub.
Okay.
Yeah, there she is.
It's outside, right?
Yes. Yeah.
She's starting there.
She used to be over by the Aquatic Center, but we'll be starting there and making a circuit around campus. And so when we convene back at the Goddess of Democracy after we make our circuit, we're going to have a platform of speakers from various organizations in the community. We've invited UBC officials to speak as well. And we are going to hopefully have some student voices added to the mix. And the purpose of that is that this is a huge conversation. So one of the things... I'm sure everyone took a look at that Facebook page for Take Back the Night.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a mess. Mm. In terms of, there were a lot of varying opinions and a lot of...
exclusions, I guess.
A lot of calls out for being exclusionary. So a lot of the issues were really valid. So there was just... It wasn't very constructive. It was really derailing from the actual issues that face a lot of people on campus, no matter, you know, what their identities are. And so one of the dangers in discussing things in very broad terms is that violence is perpetrated against very specific groups of people. And so there's lots of research to back this up, and there were representatives from like Aboriginal communities that Take Back the Night talking about violence against Aboriginal women, and
there was the transgender.
Yes, yeah. So trans issues are a huge thing, and it's not talked about nearly enough about how many trans folks face violence in their intimate relationships.
You were telling me earlier, it's about 50%.
Yeah, I've seen statistics that are like 50% of people who are trans will face violence in their intimate relationships sometime in their life, which is really horrifying, right? Mm.
So how do you take all of these issues, right? There's a lot of issues that stem from this, mm-hmm. and make it into something that's effective, but at the same time respectful to all of those issues, because one of those things that we were talking about earlier at Take Back the Night was that really there were so many issues, so many people trying to make sure their issue was heard, that it became this sort of like babble of different things, mm-hmm. and lost a lot of its like focus. And I think that was a lot of the criticism for it and why people didn't take it seriously. So making it focused,
making it accessible,
yet very respectful.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really easy to get caught up in all of these personal stories, because at the root of it, these are people's personal stories, and you have to be, I think, really respectful and very sensitive to that, while at the same time trying to think, okay, what is at the root of this problem? Why is it that so many people are experiencing violence, and how do we take this back down to easier terms that people can understand? And so really what's at the root of it is consent, right? Yeah. So as part of, I mentioned the YouTube videos, we're hoping to create some sort of like maybe comedic, maybe insightful, we're still in the writing phases, series of educational YouTube videos addressing consent. And so a lot of people, when you say consent, they don't really know. They say, well, of course, like, why would anybody do that? Why would anybody in their right mind violate someone's right to say, nope, I don't want,
it's,
you know?
It's very, very situational, something it's that very, we don't understand until we're in the context.
Exactly. Yeah. And then so because when you're in a situation like that, you know, sometimes your brain shuts down. Maybe you're not in the best frame of mind, and maybe you don't realize things until after the actions have happened. Yeah. So how do we go back to the root of consent, and why aren't people, you know, enacting their own power to say no, or their power to say yes? So, like, what does consent look like in relationships? Mm-hmm. How do we empower that, you know, consent for ourselves? So I've been thinking about this really hard for a long time. And it really comes down to these everyday, almost, so let's take an example, like, really quick for a moment. Let's say you're in a club and somebody grabs your ass. So am I allowed to say ass on the air?
You can totally say ass on the air.
Awesome.
She just said ass on the air.
I did,
yes,
ladies and gentlemen.
Feels so good.
Let's say you're in a club, someone grabs your ass. It's a common enough situation, so common that you're like, oh, wow, somebody else, what a jerk, you know? But then you let it slide. You don't talk to the person. Maybe you didn't even see who it was. So how do you hold that person accountable, or how do you feel powerful enough to hold that person accountable, you know? And so why is it that there are some people who feel like they're allowed to touch another person's body even casually without their permission, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm guilty of going up to people and just sort of like playing with their hair. Mm-hmm. Maybe people are really uncomfortable with that. Maybe you didn't stop to consider, maybe I should ask before I touch this person, because they own their body. Therefore, they should have the say of what gets touched, right?
Yeah, and I guess it's interesting what you said about the YouTube videos, which I have something to say after this, but just making it known and making it very normal on UBC campus life to be kind of watching YouTube videos like this, to have that discourse constantly happening, because that way you're constantly thinking, not constantly thinking about it, but just you acknowledge it in your everyday life.
And you're aware that it's happening.
And you're aware that it's happening. And then, and I think in that way it changes the mentality on campus. And is that what you guys are hoping to do in terms of the deeper, kind of, obviously this is a long-term thing, but in terms of a longer-term...
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of the conversations that we've had in planning the march and in planning all of our other projects for the past few weeks is how to... sorry, let me gather my thoughts.
Yeah.
How to have these conversations about consent and how to normalize that in people's everyday relationships.
It's like, it reminds me of I remember when I was in high school, there was a big campaign happening to not use the word "that's so gay."
Yeah.
And I never ever thought about it, and I fully used it. And then once there was like all these posters in school, and I would see it all the time, and I was like, oh. And then I started just using like "lame" and other words, and it was without thinking. And now I would never say it, because I just, like, it's not, it feels wrong because of how many times we talked about it in high school.
Absolutely.
So I guess that's the same thing of like, and I think also there's, to use the word also, like, rape culture, which is something that was being thrown around a lot, which makes people very, very uncomfortable. I think it's really interesting that you guys are using non-consent, because I think a lot of people also don't feel comfortable with the word rape, and maybe they shouldn't, because I think that a lot of women who maybe have experienced unconsensual sex, they don't want to call it rape. I mean, women or men, they don't want to call this rape.
And I mean, I guess it's up to a person in their individual situation to determine what they'd like to call it, whatever has happened. But we were discussing. Okay, I'm going to go into another anecdote. When I was about 11, I was definitely the tallest person in the class. I hit puberty early. And then there was a boy who was the smallest boy in the class. And he was put up by a bunch of other guys to, like, start hitting me in the back of the head or something. And so I was not above putting my hand up and snitching on him, because I was like, I just wanted him to stop. It's quite annoying. Yeah. So I put my hand up and I told the teacher what was happening. And so she got this boy and myself, and she turned to him and she said, "Do you know what it's called when you touch another person without their permission? That's called assault." So her naming that seemingly trivial action, it felt huge. Like, that, at that moment, I was like, oh my God, I just wanted him to stop hitting me. Like, I didn't want to get him in trouble with assault. Like, that's a criminal offense, you know? And so in that moment, as an 11-year-old, I felt really guilty that I had gotten him in trouble, because I didn't really have anything against him, you know.
And all of a sudden it turned into a bigger...
But all of a sudden it turned into something bigger, because my teacher had used the word to identify seemingly trivial actions. Mm-hmm. So it is important, I think, to use the word rape to identify something, because it has this really visceral reaction in people.
Exactly.
And it is that level of really serious, right?
Yeah.
It's important to put names to things. It's really important, I think, looking back retrospectively, to look at my own reactions. I didn't want him to get in trouble, and I felt guilty that I had gotten him in trouble. And so there is that silencing of the self, right?
And something that ends up perpetuating it, because not only did you not say anything, but because you didn't say anything...
Well, I did end up saying things,
but
because
if I hadn't,
yes.
But then if you do, isn't that kind of a double-edged sword? Because then you felt bad about it, right?
We have to look at why I felt bad about it. I felt bad because it was a seemingly trivial thing, and I didn't think he should get in. So there's, okay, if we're going to put this in plainer terms, the victim protecting the perpetrator. And if we look at instances of, you know, acquaintance rape, say, you know, you are friends with somebody and you don't really want to get them into a huge amount of trouble, but something terrible was done to the victim. That needs to be acknowledged, and I think it's a really, obviously, a really tricky situation. Acknowledging these situations and always sort of bringing it back to, okay, this is, you know, what's happening to the victim. We need to put the actual words to it, and then look at what keeps people silent, and then try to work against that. But, like, that's, I think, more of a reactionary measure, and so educating about consent is more of a mitigation of that. So how do we get into sex ed health programs, right, in elementary schools and high schools, which is, you know, I don't really remember what I learned in sex ed, which is kind of terrible.
Well, and also, I guess that issue never came up when I think about sex ed. Maybe. But it never came up to the extent that we were learning about consent ever. I never even learned that word. But what I was going to say is, the whole bringing it into educational places comes the next question about bringing it into the institution that is UBC, something that we were also talking about earlier. Basically, just because when I asked Stephen Toop at the press conference about, you know, rape culture, I threw it out there, and he was pretty uncomfortable, and just kind of with this notion of rape culture on campus. And then I got the idea that I wasn't really sure that there was going to be any sort of university-sanctioned event, university-sanctioned panel discussion, something about making this something mandatory that students have to do, organized by administration. So what would be your take on that? Do you think UBC should be doing this, or should you just keep it grassroots with all the problems that come with grassroots?
I think in telling the stories, the students, it needs to be grassroots. So students need to come forward, I think, with their own stories, because this is such a sensitive and personal issue that there are a lot of people this doesn't even cross their mind, and that's their privilege, and that's great. You know, you've never had to deal with sexual assault with a friend or something like that. You don't think it's a systemic issue. It is, and therefore it is the responsibility of the university to make sure that their students know this is an issue and they take measures to fight against it. So there have been a lot of ideas put forward, and the university is addressing this very seriously, which is fantastic, and also why the students need to have this conversation now. So there has been talk of a task force that the university is putting together. They've just started meeting. But the university is taking suggestions from the students. They're taking suggestions from experts in the community on the issue of sexual assault, like systemic sexual assault. And by systemic, I mean there are specific groups of people who keep getting victimized. They will be presenting their findings to university in January, this task force. So it is being addressed. Whether or not that is a transparent process, we'll see. But I think on all fronts, like, everyone sort of needs to be working to address these things, because, you know, when you think about it, there are so many issues for us to devote our time to, right? There's environmental issues that are really, really important, you know? But if we can't take care of ourselves, and if we can't find that power in ourselves to address these issues and that energy, like, how do we expect to even consider all of these other issues, right?
Oh, that was beautiful. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. But one last little point, if I have a sec, is just, like, talking about those two things. Do you think that any of the ways so far that UBC has dealt with this that have been labeled as one-dimensional ways, making sure you're walking with somebody, making sure there's more lighting, do you guys have a problem with any of those ways? Are you accepting them and then moving on to try and open up those solutions in January?
The thing about all of the, so there's been a sort of jump in logic where people can't understand how telling people not to walk alone at night, given certain circumstances, is victim blaming. They can't really see how that connects. Mm-hmm. A lot of women, perhaps yourself included, already take these measures. They already make sure they're not walking alone at night. They make sure they'd be able to, you know, call for help, or maybe you talk on your cell phone if you're walking by yourself at night. So people are already aware that by virtue of being a woman, somehow I'm in danger, right? And so having an institutional power like the RCMP or UBC say, hey guys, don't walk alone at night, just a friendly reminder, it really is, it's a bit patronizing. And so if they keep putting all these Band-Aid solutions on and not actually addressing root issues, and UBC is addressing root issues, which is fantastic. This is cool. We're in, like, this time of change. But if you aren't addressing root issues, why is it that this keeps happening? So, okay. You know, awesome. As long as we're keeping working towards it.
I do understand that. That's really, actually, I had no idea that there was this task force coming about. So we'll have to see how that pans out.
I don't even know if I was supposed to let the cat out of the bag, but too late.
Well, it is out. No, that's sweet, though. Anyway, so this is Laura Fukumoto, and from the Campaign to Reclaim Consent. Again, if anybody's interested in going to the event, this will be happening on Friday at 7?
November 22nd at 5 p.m.
5 p.m.
We'll be having speakers and some discussion afterward.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Nina and Laura, for that interview. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but please stay tuned.
Dear sir. Mr. Cousins told me that they were away when it happened. They recollected being asked.
For the Country Entirely, a play in letters. The pilot episode of Radio Free Stein, a large-scale sound project based on the writings of Gertrude Stein. Friday, May 3rd at 8 p.m. at Western Front, 303 East 8th Avenue, Vancouver. Admission, $5. For details, go to front.bc.ca.
Are you looking for career information relevant to your arts degree? Come check out Work Your BA, a career workshop series specifically designed for art students. Find out what you can do with your major, learn how to improve your resume, discover the secrets to networking, and much, much more. For more information, visit www.arts.ubc.ca/students/workyourba.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have episode 3 of In Their Shoes.
Hello and welcome to the third episode of In Their Shoes. I'm Mormai Zanke, and each week I ask people what they would do if they were in a certain political figure or celebrity's shoes. The past 2 weeks I've come to you guys with some pretty tough political questions, so this week I thought I would change it up and ask a question related to pop culture and the media. Our question was, if you were Miley Cyrus, what would you say to your fans about your current behavior? Even though this is a lighter question, it is still very controversial in the world today. Miley Cyrus recently has had a complete turnover in her public appearance. She went from being, you know, the innocent child star Hannah Montana to a provocative, controversial young woman at the forefront of pop media culture. We all know her VMA performance with Robin Thicke, where she came on stage with a foam finger and did some pretty wacky, funky stuff that a lot of her fans saw. Some approved, some didn't approve. It was just a very interesting, unsettling performance, to say the least, and I think it definitely caused everyone to think, what's going on with Miley Cyrus? Who has she become? Is this, you know, a good representation of who I want my children to look up to? All sorts of these kind of important social questions came up and just sort of completely took over the internet in an explosion. That event was about a month ago, but recently at the EMAs, she accepted her award for Best Music Video and smoked a joint just right there on stage. She said she thought her fans would love it. And so this kind of sparked another internet flurry, and now we're talking about Miley Cyrus again. We keep coming back to who is Miley Cyrus, what did she become, and why is it important? So I thought this week it'd be a perfect question to bring to you guys and to see what the students thought at UBC. If you were Miley Cyrus, what would you say to your fans?
I would do this. Sticks out tongue and looks at fans.
I loved this response from Nina. It was very, very funny. But this is the image Miley Cyrus has created. She's become the butt of many jokes. She's become this kind of enigma for silliness and just entertainment. That's one way to look at it. But another person, Brandon, who I interviewed, you know, got a little bit more on the sensitive side of who Miley is and maybe why she's doing this.
I guess it's really hard to explain, but, just trying to picture yourself in her shoes, I would assume that she would say that she's going through something, especially after falling out with her husband. So, I guess she would say that she's going through a lot and that she's just expressing herself in this form of art, I guess. And I would hope that her fans would agree with it. I mean, it's hard to take in because it's a lot, but I guess she hopes that just respect her for what she's doing because it's how she is finding a way to express herself.
I love what he had to say about still respecting her as an individual. I think a lot of people forget that when we're talking about Miley. She becomes this weird, far-off figure of a girl who's, you know, going through a lot of changes in her life, but we don't realize that she's actually a real human and has feelings and is someone that is going through a lot of pressure in the career she has fallen into. Jumping away from that perspective, two individuals that I interviewed, Rebecca and Patrick, had this idea that this was just an opportunity for Miley to rebrand herself.
I'm Rebecca, and I feel like her actions in and of themselves are the message. I mean, it's more of a way to rebrand herself and create a new identity for herself, all of which is marketable in her field, and that is the message. She might not be speaking to her same, like her old fans in the same way she used to, but this is who she wants to be right now, and that's what the message is.
Hi, I'm Patrick Fuller. If I were Miley Cyrus, I think I would be proud of what I'd done. My intention was to generate interest about me, and that's what's happened. I mean, I'm the head of all pop culture news stories at the moment. My songs are chart-topping. I'm the next big thing, and it's achieved what I intended to.
What really stuck out with me from those responses is when Patrick said, "I'm the next big thing." And this is something that is so true. Miley Cyrus has become the attention of so many people across the world. Everyone's looking at her. To be honest, she must love it. Of course, there are people with the concern of how Miley Cyrus will be an idol to their younger daughters or children. And I think that Leo, our next speaker, has something really good to say about this.
What would I say to my fans if I was Miley Cyrus? I'm Miley Cyrus. I don't need to say anything to my fans. I make a lot of money. I'm only going to have fun. No, just kidding. The thing is, like, Miley Cyrus isn't someone to look to be looked up to. She's just an entertainer. She makes something that makes people happy, and you know, if you don't like what she does, then you don't have to listen to her. And there's no reason to criticize. The better thing to do is to create something yourself.
One of my favorite things that Leo said is that if you don't like what she does, just create something else. That's a very powerful statement, and I think he hit the nail on the head with that one. It really, why do we care so much? She's just someone expressing herself. If you don't like it, just express what you want to express in your own way. She isn't the only one who dictates what we see in this world through the art and the media and in the culture. If you don't like it, do what you want to do. Our next speaker, Talita, I think sums up what everyone in the segment was really trying to say.
I'm Talita, and if I was Miley Cyrus, I think I would, I don't know, I'm growing up, I'm getting older, people change. I don't think I would try to explain myself too much because I'm human.
It's really funny, but what Talita said, that I'm not going to explain myself because I'm human, is actually very similar to what Miley Cyrus herself said in an interview. But I don't really care what the media says because I don't Google myself, so I don't know what they say, and I don't care. So there you have it. Miley Cyrus doesn't care, and I think most of the people, judging from our interview with these students, don't really care either. She's just a human, she's just doing her thing, she's figuring life out like we all are, and that's cool, and I think that we should support her for it. This has been the third episode of In Their Shoes. I am having so much fun talking to students on campus. This week was great talking about Miley Cyrus. There were some really wonderful responses, and I can't wait till next week to get back out there and hear what you all have to say. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Morme, for that piece. Our next segment is Morgan's interview with Doug Doyle, who spoke today on University Boulevard about the Reed Water feature, which is a model of sustainable water collection and distribution.
So this is Morgan Yee for News 101. I'm out in the rain with Doug Doyle, who just did a presentation on the water feature on University Boulevard. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you doing?
Can you, for the listeners, just give a quick recap of what you talked about?
Sure. I mean, the water feature that sits here on U Boulevard, just east of the Martha Piper Fountain, is primarily an aesthetic water feature, but it incorporates some interesting sustainable practices that basically it collects the water between the buildings on this street and runs it into a cistern at the very bottom of the water feature, pumps it back up to the top of the water feature. Now, as that water comes back down through the water feature, it passes through reed beds that help absorb some of the nutrients and chemicals that are in the water, and it helps the plants grow. But what it also does is it takes those nutrients out of the water so that eventually when we have to discharge this water into the storm sewer system, it's cleaner and has less chance of causing any environmental damage. So it's not the primary purpose of the fountain, but it's a really good example of the kinds of things we can do with these sort of passive, sustainable environmental systems.
Right. Now, how is it pumped up?
It's a little electric pump, just okay, powered by electricity, and it runs up. There's nothing particularly fancy about it. If the power is out, the ponds stop running and those little cascades you see stop, and then someone has to fix the pump.
Now, how big of a cistern are we're standing right now on the platform covering the cistern? How big is that?
Good question. I actually don't know the exact size of it. My guess is it stores probably about 7 or 8 cubic meters of water. It's about 8,000 liters.
Okay. Now, is there ever any worry that something from the cistern could
it's
leak
concrete.
At all?
No, okay. It's a concrete tank, and if it leaks, the water goes into the ground, which would be actually no different than if it was just the rainwater soaking through the grass into the soil underneath. So really, there's what this gives us the opportunity to do is it gives us the ability to deal with a little more water more quickly with the reed beds than it would naturally deal with going through the grass and doing the typical groundwater life cycle of rain.
And what is this kind of water feature a substitute for?
Typically or traditionally, all the water that would come between these buildings would be harvested by drains in the buildings and lawn drains and catch basins, go into a single pipe underneath the street, and it would run out, connect to the rest of the stormwater drainage system on campus, and then discharge to the ocean directly. You know, here, the rainwater doesn't immediately go to the stormwater system, and it only goes into the stormwater system when the system overflows. So it comes out cleaner, and it's less likely to be going to the system. By the time April or May rolls around, it's probably a lot of water stored in here, but we start pretty dry at the start of the fall. So it takes a little while for the rainwater to accumulate here because we are just recirculating it all the time, and evaporation does take a fair amount away.
And now, what are the dangers of rainwater just flowing over, over hard surfaces?
Uncontrolled rainwater allows for flooding to occur, which could mean buildings or lab material or library stuff gets damaged, which is, pretty tragic, and trying to recover from that kind of damage is tough. The other thing we really worry about, too, is overland flows of the water going over the cliffs, and we've made a number of efforts over the last 40 years to ensure that we don't get rainfall going over the cliffs, because if it carves new channels into the cliff faces, that will accelerate the cliffs falling down, which recently there was a cliff face failure up around the Museum of Anthropology, and that was due to erosion occurring at the toe, we believe. We're just waiting for the engineering report on that, or at least Metro Vancouver's engineering report on that, but it's the kind of thing we want to avoid, and so we're trying to keep things as minimal impact on Pacific Spirit Park as we can. So we're looking at trying to control and slow down and clean up the stormwater that comes off campus in such a way that our neighbors don't have to deal with the effects of our existence.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks. And good work on this project.
Cheers.
We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributors segments.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the Helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the Helpline is one of the many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The Helpline number is 604-696-4666. Or contact us at aidsvancouver.org.
I was a prisoner.
I was a prisoner.
I was a prisoner of cocaine.
Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my dream. It made me lie, steal.
Cocaine took my will, my soul.
And all I wanted was more cocaine.
More cocaine.
Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
Contact Cocaine Anonymous toll-free by calling 866-662-8300 or find them online at ca-bc.ca.
Up next, we have the student hot topic. This week, Christine asked students, how do you think the Canadian image has been changed by the recent media coverage of Toronto Mayor Rob Ford?
Welcome to this week's segment of the Hot Topic. Recent media coverage of Toronto Mayor Rob Ford has been sweeping international attention. Ford's admittance to alcoholism and drug abuse led to further allegations on his sexual association with prostitutes and female associates. Questions on these new allegations sparked a string of curses and explicit language on Mayor Ford's part, all on live television. Many comedians like Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart have gotten the attention of the international community by cleverly satirizing this issue. CITR reporters questioned the effect this media coverage was having on the image of Canada as a whole. Subsequently, reporters went out this afternoon to collect statements from students at UBC, asking, how do you think the Canadian image has been affected by recent media coverage on Toronto Mayor Rob Ford?
What's your name?
Emmy.
And what faculty and what year are you in?
I'm in science and I'm in first year.
And what's your name?
My name's Christina and I'm in science first year as well.
Awesome. How do you think the Canadian image has been affected by recent media coverage on Toronto Mayor Rob Ford?
I just think that it makes us look, I don't know, he's kind
makes
of portraying
like a joke.
Makes us look stupid.
Like our parliament's not.
Because he is acting stupid.
Well, totally. And it makes it seem like our parliament's not, like, legitimate if we have this man that's, like, alcohol abuse, like, drug abuse, like, in parliament. Like, he shouldn't really be making decisions.
No.
So this negative image of Canadians, how do you think it'll impact the average citizen?
I don't know. I feel like it might not have that big of an impact because most people, like when you go to Europe or something, if they find out you're Canadian, they automatically assume you're just like super nice.
And especially since, like, I know that a lot of Canadians do think he's acting in, like, in the wrong. He's totally in the wrong. So I think the fact that like other countries would know that we think he's in the wrong as well. So I don't think it's like we're supporting him. It's like we're kind of, I don't know.
And while he is, like, he does have a position of power, it is only, like, one city. Like, he is only in charge of one city, not, like, all of Canada. So the decisions he makes doesn't necessarily have an effect on, like, us in Vancouver, I guess.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah,
Thank you. Okay, so what's your name?
Evelyn.
And what year and what faculty are you in?
I've actually graduated. I'm an alumni. UBC alumni, graduated from Faculty of Arts, did psychology and English. Yeah.
And I'm Abigail, and I'm currently in fourth year and studying in arts with a Bachelor of Arts in Music. So.
Great. How do you think the Canadian image has been affected by recent media coverage on Toronto Mayor Rob Ford?
I think he probably does not have the best reputation to represent the country in that way. At the same time, like in him even acknowledging that there are some issues, I mean, that's like a bold step for him to take. So, I mean, for the world to hear about it, you know, I think they start questioning, it's like, who are these people in leadership, you know? And I think it's not only a question about, like, how we're seen internationally, but also nationally, you know? What are people thinking of in terms of, this is our leader who's leading us. And yet, you know, we're questioning his morality and, like, the choices that he's making in his life, you know? And so I think, it definitely has an effect on how people view us.
Yeah, so I guess, it's being shot viewed worldwide, so definitely everyone's probably seeing him as being a representative of the people of Toronto. He definitely represents the people, and his image is just, I guess, tainted by that, and just, I guess, the world's just sort of questioning his reputation right now and his authority as the mayor right now, and just not giving a good kind of image for the world right now.
Do you guys think the Canadian public should vie for Toronto Mayor to step down immediately from his role?
I think, we need to evaluate what's happening. Like, what are these allegations? Are they true? So there's a whole process that they're going through, which I hope that they're going through in a thorough manner in that way. I think, maybe as, like, the public as well, like, we might have our opinions as well, but I think it's hard for us to affect that change, like, we can tell them and say, maybe I think we should reconsider our those people in our leadership, you know, who are these people? But I feel like sometimes the process is really slow as well in the federal government.
Definitely the people of Toronto, they have a say in this, right? So I think it's definitely important for them to